The small town movie theater. It's where all the couples go on first dates. Sometimes it's the only place in town that consistently draws a large crowd. And it's a place where national culture touches down. But for reasons we'll get into, a lot of small rural towns are struggling to hold on to their movie theaters. And there's something in this struggle that feels just like a plot from a movie. You know, underdogs banding together against the odds. But what movie? I can't quite...
Today's the day, so let's get this over with.
Irving?
I'm sorry, Irving.
Come on, Walsh. We don't have all day. There's 50 more houses to tear down after yours.
He's off,
Oh, yeah, Goonies. The movie about a working-class neighborhood where people can't afford not to sell their houses to rich developers. It's the big guys against the little guys, and just when it looks like the little guys are gonna lose... they find hidden treasure from a sunken pirate ship.
There'll be no more signing today or ever again.
So, finding buried treasure just in the nick of time, that's definitely a thing of the movies. But a lot of small towns are finding practical ways to go after that triumphant Hollywood-style ending. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about the role of movie theaters in small towns around here. If a movie theater has been important to a community you know, call 816-235-2888 with the story. 816-235-2888. Jim Amos is the author of a recent article in Forbes magazine. The article asks, will the curtain close on small towns? Town movie theaters. And Jim, what's the deal? What inspired you to ask that question?
I worked for the Hollywood studio, Sony Pictures, for many years, and I saw the attrition of a lot of the smaller town movie theaters, especially many of them that I grew up with in New England in the 60s and 70s. And as studios consolidated their sales departments, fewer of the sales staff were familiar with the small towns. Most of them concentrate on the big cities and next level cities. But I felt like the small town issues that that cinema owners have wasn't being addressed. And if it was, it wasn't given the interest that it should be.
So needs like what?
Well, they need access to Hollywood product. And that sounds like a no-brainer because studios have a movie to sell and cinema owners have cinemas to open and have people come through their turnstiles. But it's gotten to the point where it's not quite that simple anymore. Some studios have instituted minimum playtime requirements of, for example, 3 weeks. On a lot of the small town theaters. Now, when you're talking about the town that I wrote about in the Forbes piece, Del Rapids, South Dakota, that has a single screen theater and a population of 3,600. You do the math, and after the first week, you've probably gotten most of the town who's interested in seeing that particular movie.
But you have to keep it open 3 weeks.
Yeah, they have to keep it open 3 weeks. So what ends up happening is the amount they lose in week three offsets the revenue and profit they bring in the first two. So it's not feasible for a lot of these small town guys to play some of these big blockbuster films.
You know, you mentioned, I mean, that your own background is coming from small towns in New England. What are you seeing there? What are you seeing with the small town movie theaters in that part of the country?
There's a town in New Hampshire called Berlin, New Hampshire, and it's up towards the Canadian border. And they used to have a lovely little theater called the Princess Theater. And they would play movies for a couple of weeks and then bring in the next one and then bring in the next one. And a few years ago, the Princess closed. And so now what happens is that the residents of Berlin and the immediate area have to drive 20 to 30 miles to places like North Conway or Lancaster. And though that may be feasible in the middle of summer in northern New England, trying to do it on a February night through kind of back roads through the White Mountains, just that's not doable. So what ends up happening is that, you know, people in Berlin, New Hampshire tend to just stay in and watch streaming movies and wait for those to come online that they can see them on Netflix or on video on demand.
What do you think is at risk here when you look at the bigger picture? I mean, is it just about one form of entertainment?
No, I think it's the whole small town feel and interaction and community experience. You know, when you really think about it, there are two major places where people in a small town community can interact with each other. One of them is movie theaters, and the other one is Sunday morning church services. So if you lose half of that, then, you know, there isn't a place for people to interact individually and in person with their neighbors anymore. And, you know, they'll greet them for 10 minutes after Sunday church services. I used to work at a theater in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and every Friday and Saturday night, you'd see the same people coming through the doors, and they would stand and talk in the lobby waiting for the movie to start, and they would stand and talk to their neighbors after the movie was over, and, you know, they'd see them again on Sunday, but at least they had that interaction with the people in their community, especially in these days where we're so interconnected online, but not in person.
Well, Jim, hang on with me. We'll talk to you more about this, and I'm especially interested in your background in film distribution and the perspective that's giving you. Hang on with me, though, okay?
Of course.
We're going to be hearing today from a lot of people who are trying to change this whole dynamic around movie theaters and small towns and doing some pretty amazing things in the process. But first, we want to tell the story of a chain based in Liberty with a lot of theaters in small towns here in Kansas and Missouri. The whole enterprise goes back to the 1920s. Bob Bagby, good morning.
Good morning.
Is what you're hearing familiar to you? Does it ring a bell?
Absolutely. But we're seeing a lot of these small towns, people banding together and forming nonprofits because the theater is so important to them. We're talking small towns where they form community theaters and they have volunteers to keep it running because the movie theater experience is so important. Everybody wants it.
What is the story of B&B theaters? How did your chain get its start?
We go back to 1924, where my wife, Bridget's grandfather, Elmer Bills, bought his first theater, and with it was a piano player for the silent movies. So we go all the way back to the 1924. My dad went to work for her grandpa when he was 10 years old, selling popcorn. Later, after the war, he started his own chain of theaters. But first, he started the Bagby Roadshow. And talking about small towns, he would actually take a truck and go to set up show movies on the side of buildings and parks and community centers, sell popcorn out of the back of the truck. Then he doubled in size, and Mom took her own truck out. And one of my favorite stories with Mom was one night they had a flood, and she called the town next door and said, I can't come because we can't get across the roadway. And they said, oh, no, everybody wants the movie. We're going to send a boat for you. And they got a boat. They took her. She came back, and she
a
said,
boat take the project flood waters.
Yes, exactly. And she said, we found the story and when she passed away this year, and she ended it with, the show must go on.
Wow. So it is a real family business. I mean, anyone listening to just this short amount of you talking about it can tell that. But tell me more about the story of how this family, two families really, and this business became intertwined, because it's not just B, it's B&B.
Right. My parents ended up having movie theaters in Kansas. My wife's parents had movie theaters in Missouri, and they were best friends. Our parents were best friends. We would visit together. We would visit them on Christmas. We'd take some trips together. And somewhere in college, Bridget and I, you know, we were friends and we talked, and, you know, but somewhere along the line, we were talking one night, and we both grew up working in drive-in theaters because we had drive-ins and they were very popular at that time. And we, you know, we talked about changing speakers at the drive-in. Remember those speakers you used to hang on the, you know, we have radio sound, but you used to hang the little box on your window. But every week you'd have to go and walk the drive-in and check all those speakers. And we were both talking about that shared experience is when you change a speaker, you have to take your screwdriver, take the screw off the top and then flip the top and run, because there's always a wasp nest in there. And and that night, I think we decided we would never have anyone else to share that experience with. So we were bound together. We ended up getting married, and Bill's Theaters and
really
Bagby Theaters.
Choice when only one other person in the world understands your experience.
That's right, exactly. So we got married, and we put the family businesses together, and Bagby and Bill's, and became B&B Theaters.
So I am guessing that the business of running movie theaters has changed a lot in the time you've been in the industry, regardless of where the movie theaters are. What are some of the big changes you've witnessed?
Well, of course, the history, we've seen the coming of sound. We've seen color movies. We've seen, in my lifetime, stadium seating, digital projection. And now the biggest revelation is the luxury electric recliners and expanded food and bar in theaters. And that's really been a big change to our industry.
So people who go to movies feel all those things in their own way. How do you feel some of those changes, especially the most recent ones, from the industry side of things, from the perspective of the theater owner?
What's interesting is we take out half of the seats and put in luxury recliners, and we double our attendance. So that tells you that people really like the experience. And so we're heavily investing in city markets like Kansas City, but also in some smaller towns. And we're seeing it working in smaller towns, even like down south in Harrisonville, which is a small market. You know, we've done very well with the remodel, and people really like that experience because people still want to get out of the house. And even in my dad always said there's a kitchen in every house, but people still go out for dinner. So people don't want to stay home every night. They want to have that shared experience to cry together, to laugh together. And so, you know, it's a fun business. It's a fun family business.
What is it about the small town market that you've really gravitated toward? I mean, you, as you've mentioned, you do have theaters in cities, including Kansas City, but you're the seventh largest chain in the country, I believe, and you have tons of rural locations, including here in Kansas and Missouri, but not only here. I mean, other states too.
Right. That was kind of our bread and butter. That's where we started. And so we've stayed loyal to those towns as much as possible, and try to reinvest in those. And I think because of our size, we're able to pass on some of the savings from our side to smaller towns to help with the operational costs, where an individual would have a harder time doing that.
Do you, even as a chain, face challenges keeping small town theaters open, challenges that are unique to that environment?
Well, as Jim was talking earlier about the number of weeks you have to play a movie, and so we no longer have towns with one or two or three screens. The smallest we have is four, so that we can play movies and play them according to the studio schedule. So if you're a single-screen theater in a small town, it's very difficult. You've got to usually play a movie off what's called off the break a few weeks after it's been released.
Have you been able to witness what some of these theaters mean to the communities where they exist? I mean, obviously you don't live in every town that has a B&B theater. You couldn't. You're from Liberty, right?
Right.
So, but what have you witnessed in either your visits to these communities or your conversations with the people who work in the theaters?
People are so excited when we open a new theater in a smaller market, and you see the high school band come out for the opening night because they want to be there. And you know, you see the mayor and the city people, you know, they're just so excited. And the customers are just happy to have that experience. And as Jim said, the movie theater and the church is the two biggest places you meet. I guess I would add another one, Friday night football.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what we hear a lot when we talk with people about schools in smaller towns, that the school football games are a big deal.
That's our biggest competitor in the fall, Friday night football.
But tell me about the most recent B&B location to open in a small town or rural community. Can you tell me the story of that experience, what it was like, what it meant to the community, what brought you there?
Let me think. A few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, we opened a town close by in Lexington, Missouri. And that town was really trying to revitalize itself. And there was a lot of strong city people, you know, very excited about having it. And the reaction was just very positive. People were very excited to see a movie theater come. And we ended up putting a sixth screen there.
How's it doing?
It it's fair. You know, it pays its bills, but it doesn't make a lot. But, you know, I kind of our attitude in the family, you get, you know, several of these that make a little bit and put it together, you keep them going.
Tell me about some of your personal favorite locations, where they are and why you like them.
Well, right now, I have to say my favorite location is the brand new theater we just opened in Liberty. We had a theater that closed 2.5 years ago because our lease was up, and so we bought land across the street and just opened it 2 weeks ago, and it's very fun. We have the largest Screen X theater in the world.
What is Screen X?
Yeah, that's really fun. You know, you watch your movie down front on the big screen, but Screen X, there's 5 projectors on each side of the walls. And so at certain viewing times when there's a big action sequence, the projectors kick on and you have a 270-degree experience. And we worked with this company out of South Korea to bring the technology here. And they had done it in smaller theaters. We said, no, we want it to be on our grand screen. So we put it in Liberty. We made a big deal with them to do it. And it's so much fun. I saw Ant-Man there a couple of weeks ago. And, oh, my gosh, I mean, the action scenes and it's going all the way around you. It's really fun. So that's my most fun thing now. And to have the biggest one in the world is in my hometown is pretty fun. It's 4 minutes from my house.
What kind of investment does that constitute? I mean, I can imagine, you know, working with a foreign company to pull this off. Like, that's a major business deal.
A major business deal, yes. Let's just say a lot.
So is it, I mean, I am guessing that there are theaters, when you talk about that some of, like, that the theater in Lexington is just paying the bills. That's not going to be an option for every movie theater in every community.
Right, exactly. And that's why I think you're seeing the struggles of the smaller town theaters. You know, it's just costing more for film, costing more for the cost of operating theater has gone up so much because the digital projection is so much more expensive to operate, and the amenities and the laws and things you have to do to follow all the rules, you know, is a lot more expensive than it used to be. So it's definitely more difficult, and which is why, of course, we've moved into larger situations in the last 10 years.
Jim Amos, jump back in here. What do you hear in the story of B&B Theaters?
Well, I know B&B well from the time that I spent at Sony, and also I was at STX. And I love that Bob and everybody spread their theaters out from, like you said, being in big cities like Kansas City to small towns as well. I love family-run businesses, to be quite honest with you. My background, my dad ran a small chain of movie theaters in New England. So, you know, when I hear Bob talk about things that are important to small-town theaters, I know it because, you know, I remember my dad talking about theaters in Winooski, Vermont, and Caribou, Maine. And if you're interested in how big those towns are, I think you can probably tell by the name they're not very big. Bob's right about the Friday Night Football. That's also a big community draw, probably the biggest and their biggest competition. But, you know, I think that, you know, the importance of providing a out-of-home experience is so important to the success of theaters, whether they're small or large. It's not viable anymore to simply slap up 4 walls and a walkway down the middle and expect people to put down their Netflix and go and shell out $9 for a ticket to go see a movie. You have to make it a pleasant experience for one they can't get anywhere else. And like Bob said, whether it's a greater variety of beer and food offerings, or whether it's recliner seating, or whether ScreenX or 3D or 4D, you have to make it. You have to provide the impetus for people in that town to say, I have to experience Mission Impossible Fallout on the big screen. Have to see Jurassic World there.
The things you're talking about do, as we said, that's everything you do beyond those 4 walls is also an additional investment, right?
It is. And obviously, that's something that people like Bob and everybody involved in theater operation have to balance. And another thing that's really poised to become a big issue is labor costs as well. I mean, we hear an awful lot about $15 minimum wage, and that's a wonderful concept. It's how, but how a small business, like a small town theater operator, copes with increased labor costs is going to be something to really watch over the next few years.
Well, we're going to take a short break. I do want to thank Bob Bagby for joining us. Bob, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bob runs B&B Theaters. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about what movie theaters mean to small towns, especially in rural communities here in Kansas and Missouri. Coming up, the film commissioner who's taken up the fight for small town movie theaters, not just in his state, but all over the country. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the importance of the movie theater in small towns around here. It's more than just a place to see movies. As we've heard, we've been chatting with Jim Amos, who wrote an article about the existential threat to small town movie theaters across the country in Forbes magazine. Hi again, Jim.
Hi.
And now let's turn to the Colorado film commissioner who's been pioneering in the approach he's been taking to save small town movie theaters in his state. Donald Zuckerman, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
Your fight really began a few years back when all the projectors had to go digital or bust. Can you remind us what that was all about?
Certainly. So the studios decided to switch from analog or film to digital. And as a result, all the projection systems were obsolete. And what would happen if a theater could not afford a DCP or digital cinema projector, which could range from $40,000 to $60,000, they couldn't get content. They couldn't get anything to play. So they'd go out of business.
And what did that mean for small towns in rural Colorado, even just that threat?
Well, I think that you got to look at, you know, a little bit of the history. So first of all, picture this. The movie theater is a grand palace. I mean, these structures are magnificent, and they were built in the 20s, 30s, and 40s when these towns were thriving. And now... without the movie theater, there's an existential threat to the downtown. I mean, imagine all of a sudden probably what might be the biggest structure, the most magnificent structure on the main street is dark. And the luncheonette or the restaurant next door and the bar across the street and the shops go out of business. What happens to the town?
Did you see that in some of the towns in Colorado, that scenario playing out?
No, we didn't, because I think we prevented it. So going back 5 or 6 years ago, the Denver Film Society invited me to a meeting with the Betcher Foundation to basically, they were going hat in hand. They're a not-for-profit, and they needed 3 digital projectors, and they were looking for some funding. And when at the meeting, the CEO of Betcher said, are you aware that there are small town theaters all over the state that are having the same problem? And when we became aware of that, I work in the office of the State Office of Economic Development. I came back here and we met with everybody here and we said, we've got to do what we can to prevent this. And then what I think we've done can serve as a model for other states, because what we did was we got together with the Economic Development Commission, which allocated $200,000. We got together with the Betcher and the Gates Foundations and crowdfunding. And because each theater was required to, show some skin in the game, come in with something. And we succeeded in funding DCPs for 13 rural theaters. And
what are DCPs? 12, Sorry.
So that's, I'm sorry, it's a digital cinema package.
Oh, gotcha.
And that's basically the projector.
So, as I was researching this, you are quoted in article after article. You're also quoted in press releases for, like, every grant program out there, basically, that is now kind of coming to the rescue in some ways throughout the country. There are grants from the USDA, from the Gates Foundation, a lot of others, to help small-town movie theaters stay afloat. And it does sound like you were really out in front on that for finding kind of a nonprofit model rather than just crossing your fingers and hoping the private sector would work it out. Am I getting that right?
Well, I think so. The thing is this, that part of the issue with foundations sometimes is that they can only fund not-for-profit companies, and not all of these theaters are not-for-profit. So I think of the 13 theaters that were funded, seven were for profit. And when I say for profit, I mean not really profitable, but, you know, hanging in there.
That they're still on a commercial model?
Well, they had never formed a 501c3, a not-for-profit. They never organized as one. So they weren't eligible to receive funding from the foundations. So they had a slightly greater task of raising more money, but we funded them as well.
It's interesting to me that the Department of Agriculture has taken an interest in the issue of movie theaters in small towns. Can you explain the connection there?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that most of these small towns are in agricultural areas, and they're hanging in there. And, the biggest building on Main Street goes dark, you know, what happens to the next generation? What's to encourage young people to stay there? And then, you know, one of the arguments when we were presenting this case was, you know, if the nearest theater is 40 miles away, and as your previous guest pointed out, you know, a lot of times it's the first date is at a movie theater. Do you really want your 17, 18-year-old kids driving 40 miles on a dark road and having to drive back 40 miles at night? No. And then there's also the issue that maybe they'd have a beer while they're on their way too. So, from a safety point of view, but, you know, we're primarily interested in economic development. And, you know, it was interesting when we presented this to the Economic Development Commission and asked for $200,000. Not only did they support it unanimously, but then Dick Monfort, who was the chair at the time and the owner of the Rockies, said, come back for more if you need it.
Wow.
So, yeah. Everybody saw the need. And I think that we've become a model. And I loved what you said about me leading the charge around the country, but it's absolutely not accurate. I haven't even seen these articles that I'm quoted in, other than maybe the first one.
So other people are taking you up as their sort of role model rather than you deliberately leading a charge?
Yeah, and here, you know, it was really interesting. A lot of people, so the Denver Film Society decided to basically do the work of getting these cinema packages installed because they had the expertise. And an organization called Downtown Colorado Inc. went out and contacted every single rural theater in Colorado to see if they had already made an installation or if they had the money or not. So there was a tremendous community effort that we were, you know, centrally involved in. Let's put it that way.
So I have a question for you just about the sort of external funding model, like crowdfunding to pay for like the big expense that's right in front of a theater in a small town to keep the door open. But does that just kind of, if you imagine that this is like a hurdling course or something, does that just get you over one hurdle only to face another one that that you then have to make another plan for, or is this sustainable?
Well, we chose to go with trying to be sustainable. And so first of all, the crowdfunding thing. So imagine this, what you're really doing is you're saying to your own community, we can qualify for a grant from Boettcher or Gates for X amount of dollars. We can get Y amount of dollars from the state, but this is the balance we need. And if you want us to get that other money, we need your help. And so the communities responded. You know, you have farmers, ranchers who kicked in and saved the theaters. They're as responsible for saving the theaters as we are.
You know, we had a caller who wasn't able to stay on the line. She called us at 816-235-2888 to say that she went to a theater in Shawnee that was remodeled so that it could also host live theater productions. And she was wondering if the small towns that are struggling to keep their theaters open could use them for more than just movies and whether that would help. What are your thoughts?
And they do. So we have the Hippodrome Theater in Julesburg. That's in the northeast corner of Colorado. They've incorporated an art gallery, a small theater museum, an event meeting space in their theater. The Grand Theater in Rocky Ford on the Eastern Plains performs community plays on their stage. These theaters serve as community meeting spaces. So most of them are trying to do other things. I mean, one of them has an ice cream store in the theater. So I think they need to find other ways to get revenue. And I think what's interesting about, the article in Forbes is it points out the other problems that when we were doing this never occurred to anybody. For instance, the required play for 3 weeks. I mean, that has to be pretty deadly in a small town.
Yeah. Well, Donald Zuckerman, hang on with me. I want to talk about a town near here, El Dorado Springs, a town of about 3,500, where they recently restored an old theater. The building had been a landmark in town, but then the theater itself actually closed in 1974. And for a while, it was home to, as I understand it, kind of a dusty antique store. But then a couple of brothers in town bought the building, brought it back to life, took a lot of work and investment. Over about a year, they got it reopened just in time for that whole digital projector conversion, which would have priced them right out of business if not for organized fundraising efforts and the contributions of volunteers. Cameron Cowell lives in El Dorado, and he's here with us now. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
What does the movie theater in El Dorado mean to you?
Well, let me start off as I do not live in El Dorado Springs. I live in Lenexa, Kansas. So, El Dorado Springs Movie Theater is kind of a unique theater. It's a theater. It's not a grand theater. It's not huge. It only holds about 125 people. And you're right. I think they went through some problems going into the digital age, but there were a group of individuals there. They got together and fundraised, and they were able to buy a digital projector. It's a great place to be, but they're still having some problems. They're kind of at the point where I think they need some new management. And I think as we talk about these small theaters, I think that management comes into play. How do you manage them? But I think that the...
Wait, can you explain that?
Well, I think that what you do is when you get a board that has volunteers on it that work 24 hours a day and then have to come and work the theater too.
You're saying a lot of times farmers.
Yes.
And working 24 hours a day.
Right. And it just gets to the point where it gets old. And so you kind of lose a little bit of the enthusiasm. And so things kind of fall apart. Now, in the case of El Dorado Springs, it sustains itself. But I think we're looking again at sustainability. And we were talking about the other things that we can do. So our idea is to add to it a documentary film festival. So that's really kind of what we're going to do.
What gave you this interest if you're living in another town?
Well, my history is that really what gave me the interest in film and documentary film festivals is I'm an ex-Peace Corps volunteer. I was in Central America and ran into a gentleman down there from Argentina who got me to go down to Argentina for a week. They were doing a film festival down there, and I was just taken by this film festival. It was all documentary work. Kind of taught me a little bit about what was going on in South America at the time, and really enjoyed myself. So since then, that's all I've ever really wanted to do, is to put together a documentary film festival in a small community.
Why? But what drew you to El Dorado Springs in particular?
I met a gentleman that told me that the theater was for sale, the theater itself. So I walked down there, and I didn't walk. I drove down there and met with the board that runs it, and met with the owner of the building, the Davin, and they were just all into it. They just loved it. They just thought it was the greatest thing going. That's what I was looking for. All the other communities that I went to, there was some interest in the theater, but not a great interest in it. And in this case, there was a great interest in keeping this theater there. They hold a annual picnic, Founders Day picnic there, and it draws 10,000 people in this little community, plus the fact that it sits next to a couple big lakes. There's a draw there, and I thought, well, that's a great place to go.
So do you think that a film festival is something that can kind of be at least a partial answer to some of these questions, like this question of how do you deal with the three-week minimum of commercial films that are in heavy rotation? A film festival kind of gets around that in some ways, I'm guessing.
I think so. I think it does. And the cost of the film, too. We were talking about that. You know, it is this 3 weeks and the cost of film. They're not really making a whole bunch of money off their films. I think that's one of the reasons why you're seeing the nonprofits go in, is because if you have volunteers, you don't have to pay anybody. So
let's talk to one of our callers. We've got Russ with us from Peculiar, Missouri. Hi, Russ.
Hello. Hey, a couple of things. One, that woman who called in about a cinema with a one auditorium converted to live cinema, or live theater, I should say, that's also a B&B in Shawnee. So those guys are progressive all the way around. Your person thought it might be interesting for me to relate some early history. The cinema in the town where I grew up, which was about 2,000 people, I left when we were 12, but we left when I was 12. It was a long Quonset hut, just this corrugated steel arched building with a screen at one end and a door at the other, and loose seats, like you'd find at a wedding reception or something. And that was really a center of town because it was a warm place in the mountains, and half the year that was kind of relevant. It was a large open space, so you know, dances there and socials and things like that too, along with, you know, films when they could get them. That's where I first saw Fiddler on the Roof and Apocalypse Now and a few other films, Little Big Man, a few others. But it was really a center of the community. Last I was visiting that town was about, you know, 20 years ago. And it survived as a boutique theater showing art films, even though there was a multiplex that had opened up about 2 miles away. And it was still quite relevant to the community because small communities, which only get tourists during the summer and are themselves during the winter, they depend on things like that.
You know, I want to turn back to Jim Amos. Jim, I mean, as you listen to Russ talking, from just an industry perspective, is the business of art films different from the business of mainstream films in terms of the viability of maybe, can you get an art film for 1 week? Is that a difference?
You can, but it's going to be, art film distribution is a little different from the major films. When you have Jurassic World or Mission Impossible, they take 4,000 theaters and, you know, as long as you can turn some kind of profit, you'll get a print of it and off you go. But when you have a film like RBG or Won't You Be My Neighbor or Three Identical Strangers, those distributors often go on a staggered release plan, meaning they'll take 5 theaters the first week, 25 the next, 45. So you can play the film for 1 week. The issue is that it may very well be so far into the run that the video window, and when I say video, I don't just mean DVD, I mean electronic sell-through, etc., may be only 2 or 3 weeks away. So that's an issue that you have, that, you know, you had the initial interest in a movie like an RBG, but that, you know, that was 6 weeks ago. And when, by the time you get it, you know, a lot of that buzz is gone and people may be thinking to themselves, you know what, it'll probably be on VOD, video on demand, in the next couple of weeks. Let's just wait to pay $4.99 and we can both see it and we don't have to spend $20 in tickets.
Why does it still work that way? It seems so strange because one of the things you would think would come with the digital capability would just be that, it, you know, the physicality of film, and I don't know, that that's harder to just have limitless copies out there in the world. Why be that way with digital?
Well, here's one big thing, and that is that as your previous person said, once you convert it to digital, you no longer had the big 35 millimeter prints, which cost upwards of $1,000, that studios had to buy in order to send it to these small towns. When you convert it to digital, really all it was just probably about $100 for the little digital package that you send and what's called a key in order to kind of turn it on. But also what happened is that because that conversion was done by a third party entity, those conversions weren't technically done by B&B or the small town or AMC. They were done by three third party entities like Sony or Dolby or Cinedigm was another one. So what happened is that they would charge a fee to studios in order to get to play those films, that studio's films, in those theaters. So if a studio is going to be charged, for example, $1,000 for what's called a virtual print fee, the dollars and cents approach that a studio would take would be, all right, well, am I going to get enough in film rental out of that engagement to cover the cost of what I'm paying? If the answer is no or probably no, that is a good reason in studios' minds to say, you know, I don't think so.
Well, we are hearing about the challenges of keeping movie theaters open in small towns, but also some of the new ideas people are having in these communities to keep it going. 816-235-2888. You can still get in on this conversation with a story about a town you know. I'm Gina Kaufman. Central Standard is still going. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the importance of movie theaters to small towns in Kansas and Missouri. We've been talking to Jim Amos. He's the author of an article in Forbes magazine about whether they're going to close the curtain on small town movie theaters. Hi again, Jim.
Hi again.
And we're also talking with Cameron Cowell. He is transforming right now a movie theater in El Dorado Springs. And Cameron, you were talking about that it was important to you. You're working on starting a documentary film festival.
That's right.
And you said it was important to you to do this in a small community.
And why is that? I just feel that the big cities have enough stuff going for them as it is right now. And I think that what I have done is I've looked for a community that is not too far away from a big community, which is Kansas City for us, a community that has a lot more to offer besides just the documentary film festival.
Such as
the lakes down there. The lakes are a big draw down there. It's in the Ozark community. You have Clinton and a couple other large lakes that are you also have a large presence of some colleges down there, which I'll go to get some help, of course. And I just like the area. They're very comfortable with that. Again, we're looking at how do you sustain the theater, which is really what they want to do. They want to make sure that the theater does not go.
The people of the town.
The people of El Dorado Springs and the community, the Cedar County community, they want to see it stay.
Okay. What do people tell you about that? Why it matters so much to them to see it stay?
Well, I think one comment that was made earlier is the fact that is if my child is going out on their first date, I don't want them to drive 40 miles to see a movie. I want them to be able to come here and see a movie. The area has a lot of elderly people in it that enjoy the theater itself. It's an easy drive for them. It's got some history to it. There's some personal pride in that theater. Devin Ellison, the gentleman, and his brother who put it together, put a lot of money into that theater to get it going. They knew how important it was with the community itself, and the community supported them. And that's another thing, too, is in my drive to find a place to do a documentary film festival, this has been the community that has shown the most support. They love their theater, and they're willing to do anything to keep it there. And they know that you have to have something to sustain it, because I don't really honestly think that the films themselves can sustain it. I don't think that'll happen.
So What is your model going forward? Because just the documentary film festival, like you said, like that's not enough either if it's just happening once a year.
Well, obviously, it'll be other things such as we're going to make it a music venue, too. We're going to do a series on interview series where we interview individuals from the community. But it'll be the music side of it, I think, that'll help sustain it.
And you're relying on people coming from outside El Dorado Springs to these events.
Well, sure. There's no doubt about it. But again, I get back to the fact that this little community has a annual picnic every year, and they draw 10,000 people, for crying out loud. So,
what do you think are some of the challenges you're going to face?
Oh, I think the challenges are just to get it organized and get it put together. Putting together a documentary film festival is not the easiest thing in the world to do. And there's a lot of learning going on there. So, it's how you get everybody together on one stream and accomplish it through the colleges that are around there, the people themselves, to find the people that are interested in working. There are a lot of things going on there.
Jim Amos, does this sound like a plan that could work?
Yeah, and I think you can take it even further. And there are two points I'd like to bring up, and that is that we talked about the 3-week minimum playtime for a lot of cinemas. The other thing to remember is that studios require that 3-week playtime with what's called a clean playtime, meaning you show, if you're playing Hotel Transylvania 3, you play it at 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock, at 10 o'clock. Now, we're all pretty smart people, and we realize there's probably not going to be an awful lot of people coming through at 10 in the evening to go see an animated film. So the ability for small town theaters to play a Hotel Transylvania up until 6 o'clock while playing, a Jurassic World at 8 o'clock would certainly help small town theaters. And the other thing is that event cinema, which used to be called alternative content, is something that is adding to the bottom line of a lot of the bigger theaters, and that is film presentations of Broadway, the Met Opera, rock concerts, faith-based films, and the like. And there is a entity called My Cinema who has struck a deal to provide this kind of entertainment for small town, for all theaters, but primarily small town theaters, so that they can program a couple of these a week, so that on a Wednesday night at 7:30, when you only have 12 people sitting in the theater, instead you may have 50 showing up for the filmed Kenny Chesney concert or the new film, the new faith-based film from Kirk Cameron. So I think that that's a revenue white space that will start to be available to a smaller town in the very near future.
So Donald Zuckerman is still with us. He's the film commissioner in Colorado, where they've had a lot of success keeping small town movie theaters open. They were really proactive about it. Based on your experiences with theaters and towns in Colorado, is there anything that you would caution Cameron to think about as he begins this adventure in El Dorado Springs?
Well, excuse me, not really, because first of all, we work with about 40 local film festivals, and we're actually helping two towns start a film festival now. And one of the things that is interesting is that the film festival circuit, these are films that don't usually get a theatrical release, so they're not going to be playing RBG. They're going to be getting films that aren't going to cost anything. And so they usually it's just for a weekend, or sometimes it's for a week, but somebody could do it on a fairly regular basis and source material for free. Now, the expense usually is that usually you invite the director in and have some kind of a panel discussion, and that costs money.
Is that your plan, Cameron?
That's my plan.
So you're going to have to get money for that.
There you go. I appreciate the help.
Well, and I just want to say, is attracting young families to that community in El Dorado Springs, is that something that people are talking to you about? Because that's something we've heard about.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what you're doing. I think people have forgotten the small town communities and how great they are to live in. I love that place. It's people are very friendly. It's very active. So, yeah.
Well, our time is up, but Thank you, Cameron Cowell, for talking to us from the theater in El Dorado Springs.
My pleasure.
And we've also been talking with Jim Amos and Donald Zuckerman. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can catch anything you might have missed from this discussion at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have it ready for you later today. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll switch gears from movie theaters in small towns to alleys in the city. A lot of American cities are rediscovering their alleys and giving them new life. Is that happening here? Tomorrow at 10. Today's show was produced by KCUR's Coy Duggar and intern Trevor Hook. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.